Hi, welcome to Human Emotion. Today we're going to focus on the question of to what extent do emotions actually make us moral creatures, for better or for worse? In other words, how much can emotion actually influence our behaviors, both those for the better and those for the worse? So we saw earlier in the course that definitions of morality, such as those proposed by John Haidt, suggest that morals are almost this inherent part of what make us good, or part of our human goodness and virtue. But we know that emotions don't always lead to virtuous behaviors, and in fact can lead us to perform perhaps some of the greatest evils known to mankind. So we're going to pick up this theme today in our third module on emotion and morality by talking about the bad. And in particular, we'll be talking about psychopathy and emotion. And this is our roadmap today that will guide us through this journey into the potential bad side of emotion and morality. So today we have a very special guest lecture by Dr. Joshua Buchholz, followed by our takeaway questions and expert interview. So let's begin here with our special guest lecture. So today we'll have Dr. Joshua Buchholz, an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard University, speaking with us on emotion and psychopathy. So welcome, Josh. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much, June. So we're going to begin our discussion today with a description of this man. Can any of you guess who he is? If not, that's okay. I'll give you a little bit of background information. He was a good student at Woodrow Wilson High School in Tacoma, Washington. He was active in his local Methodist church and was actually vice president of his church's youth fellowship board. He was a Boy Scout and very well liked by his troop. He went off to college at the University of Washington, where he majored in psychology, with honors, I should add, and his professors loved him. People described him as a very good and conscientious young man. He actually worked part-time at a local area suicide hotline, trying to help out those who were in trouble and in need. And he even worked as an office manager at the office of his state's local Republican Party. Now, despite this very busy schedule, he still found the time to kidnap, bludgeon, rape, torture, and strangle to death as many as 70 young women in the 1970s. Does that background information help? Can any of you guess who he is? If you guessed Ted Bundy, then that's your A for today. Now, does he look like a psychopath to you? He's a good-looking guy. He's a smooth talker. Very charming, highly intelligent. He looks pretty normal, right? So much so that this is what the judge who sentenced him to death had to say about him at his trial. So this is the judge. He said, "It is ordered that you be put to death by current of electricity, that current be passed through your body until you are dead. But take care of yourself, young man. I say that to you sincerely. Take care of yourself, please. It is an utter tragedy for this court to see such a total waste of humanity as I've experienced in this courtroom." He was talking, mind you, not about Ted Bundy, but about, or not about the victims, the many victims, but about the waste of Ted Bundy's life. Okay? "You are a bright young man. You'd have made a good lawyer, and I would have loved to have you practice in front of me. But you went another way, partner. Take care of yourself. I don't feel any animosity toward you at all. I want you to know that. And once again, take care of yourself." Now, what could have possibly possessed the judge, who had just seen some of the most gruesome and graphic evidence in the history of modern criminal law, to say such oddly warm and kind things about this man? Well, Ted Bundy seems to capture perfectly the charm, the seeming normalcy, the so-called mask of sanity that hides a roiling inferno of trouble that is often lurking just underneath. So what is this thing, this thing we call the psychopath? There's a lot of confusion and misinformation about what psychopathy is and is not, and so we'll take a moment to dissect this mysterious creature. We can think of psychopathy as a collection of related traits and behaviors, and these are often broken down into two distinct dimensions. The first of these is an emotional, interpersonal dimension. Psychopaths are glib and superficial. They're egocentric and grandiose. They lack remorse, guilt, and empathy. They are deceitful and very manipulative, and they seem to have what some have described as just a very shallow emotional experience. On the other hand, psychopaths show dramatic dramatically deviant antisocial behavior, right? They're very impulsive. They have poor behavioral controls. They show a tremendous need for excitement and they lack responsibility. They have behavioral problems that show up very early in life and, of course, have high levels of adult antisocial behavior. So that, in a nutshell, is what psychopathy is. Obviously, we'll dig deeper on that and unpack that a little bit more in a moment, but before we go further, it's useful to contrast it with what it is not. And the crucial point that I want to make here is that psychopathy is not the same thing as antisocial personality disorder as assessed by the DSM. So let's take a look at the diagnostic criteria for antisocial personality disorder, or APD, and we'll contrast them with what I've just described are the core features of psychopathy. Okay, so to get a diagnosis of APD, you have to have three or more of the following. You have to commit crimes, you have to lie, you have to be impulsive, you have to get into fights, you have to be reckless, irresponsible, or lack remorse, okay? So remember, with the DSM, this is an all or none thing. There's no dimensionality, no shades of gray. You either have it or you don't, right? All you need are just any three of these criteria. You meet criteria if you're someone who gets into fights, is impulsive, and commits crimes. That's it. Those three alone will qualify you for a diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder. It doesn't matter which crimes. It can be drug possession. It can be shoplifting, right? All the way up to assault and murder. And let's contrast that with the key features of psychopathy, right? Remember, we have these emotional and interpersonal elements of psychopathy in addition to the antisocial lifestyle components. So what we have here is a comparison of the diagnostic criteria of antisocial personality disorder on the right with the key symptoms of psychopathy, both the emotional interpersonal facet and the antisocial lifestyle facet. Now, what becomes readily apparent here is that APD maps pretty well to the antisocial behavioral features of psychopathy, but very poorly to the emotional and interpersonal facets. And so there are two takeaway points here. First, while most psychopaths are going to meet criteria for APD, the overwhelming majority of people who meet criteria for APD are not psychopaths. And that's because APD is fundamentally a diagnosis of criminality. Remember, the DSM is concerned primarily with reliability, which is why it focused on the most readily observable symptoms in constructing this diagnosis. Crime, impulsivity, fighting, all of those are observable. And this lends itself nicely to good inter-rater reliability. But being manipulative, glib, lacking empathy, that stuff is hard to operationalize. And so the creators of the DSM essentially just ignored them. And this graph here really demonstrates these two points nicely. Okay, so the square is the entire pool of criminal offenders in this country, right? Of those, upwards of about 80% are going to meet criteria for APD, while a smaller proportion, somewhere around 25%, are psychopaths. And this highlights the idea that what we're really picking up on with the APD diagnosis is just a propensity to commit crimes. Now, check out the overlapping circles. This demonstrates the other point pretty well. You can see that while most of the psychopaths would meet criteria for APD, most of the APD folks are not psychopaths. And so this brings us to our next problem. You can look through all 943 pages of the DSM and never once find the word psychopathy, which means that we're off the reservation. So pack your bags, hombres. We're heading into uncharted waters. What do we do without our psychopathological life preserver? Where do we look for guidance? Well, we look to two men, the grandfather and father of psychopathy research. Interest in psychopathy as a disorder really began in the 1940s when an Atlanta psychiatrist named Hervey Cleckley wrote one of the single most extraordinary books in the canon of psychopathology. It was called The Mask of Sanity. In it, he described a very curious group of patients who had symptoms unlike he'd ever seen before. They lied constantly, but to no real end. They almost lied just for the sake of lying. Now, they committed all manner of crimes, from petty theft to burglary and assault. and were often found to have conned large sums of money from family, friends, and strangers alike, always under false and in fact often preposterously false pretenses. Now, this antisocial behavior was what Cleckley termed inadequately motivated. There was no need for it, right? The things that these people were getting out of these crimes, they weren't things that were desired by these people. Most of these people were upper middle class suburban individuals who didn't really want for anything materially, right? They also didn't have any delusions. They had no hallucinations or any other signs of psychosis for that matter. A lot of them, as I said, came from really good homes. They were loved by their parents. They had all of the trappings of post-war upper middle class Atlanta life. They were, by all outward appearances, totally normal, but when you scratch the surface, there was no there. Now, one of his patients, who he termed Roberta, is a really good example of this. Roberta was a 20-year-old woman who had been, for the last 12 years or so, slowly destroying her family with her behavior. She'd stolen tens of thousands of dollars from friends, from parents, from parents of friends, from friends of parents, and so forth, either through direct theft or often by clever lies and manipulation. She'd been kicked out of 5 schools for a truancy, passing bad checks, and being found in flagrante delicto, as we say, with dozens of boys and men. Now, she'd left home dozens of times without leaving any word, only to be found in distant cities, performing odd jobs, living with strange men, passing bad checks, and generally conning the local populace. Now, what was so striking about Roberta was not, in fact, her criminality. For Cleckley, it was something more, or really something less. When he really examined her emotional experience, it seemed as though she and others of this breed could pantomime emotion, they could convey emotion, but it was only skin deep. As Cleckley put it, when it came to emotion, these people understood the words, but not the music. Now, Cleckley was so perplexed by the behavior of these patients and of others that he wrote a whole book about them, these psychopaths and their mask of sanity. But actually studying these fascinating creatures wasn't particularly easy. There was no standard diagnostic criteria, and people just sort of made things up as they went along. And it was this lack of standardization and lack of reliable measures that really held the field back for about 40 years or so, until this man, Bob Hare, came along and devised the instrument that is today considered to be the gold standard of psychopathy assessment. It's called the PCLR. Now, Bob was a newly minted psychologist in the Canadian prison system when he started working with these people in the early 1960s, these criminal offenders who were unlike any other criminal offenders that he'd ever known before. He started coming across prisoners who looked very much like the people that Cleckley was talking about. And, like all of us who study psychopathy, became instantly and irrevocably obsessed with this population. He craved to know what made them tick, but there was little to no good research at the time. And he recognized that this lack of a good assessment measure was stymieing the field. And so he rolled his own and created the Psychopathy Checklist, or PCL, which has been revised once and is called the Psychopathy Checklist Revised, or PCLR. And that's the gold standard measure that we still use today. The PCLR is comprised of 20 items, each of which is scored from 0 to 2. To get the score, you need 2 things. First, a structured clinical interview, which is pretty standard. And second, which actually was Hare's genius move, you need an extensive review of file material, such as court records, charging documents, prior psychiatric evaluations. Any guesses as to why this step is required? If you answered that it's because psychopaths are incredibly unreliable narrators of their own history, then that's your A for today. Now, using a technique called factor analysis, it's been shown that these various items break out essentially into the 2 dimensions of psychopathy that I described earlier. Factor 1 describes the emotional and interpersonal deficits, while factor 2 deals with the impulsive and antisocial lifestyle facets. So, that's all great. Psychopathy is very interesting to me and my colleagues and friends and so forth. But, actually, even if we don't care about abnormal psychology at all, there's a very good reason to learn more about psychopaths. See, the thing is, even though psychopaths are only a small minority of the population at large, we're talking about 1% or so of society, they commit much more than their fair share of society's crimes. And all of that crime is really, really costly. We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars every single year that's removed from our economy because of this 1% of the population. Psychopaths commit crimes earlier, they commit crimes more frequently, and the crimes that they commit are more violent than non-psychopaths. And they're much more likely to commit new crimes when they're released from prison. In fact, psychopathy is one of the single best predictors of who is likely to reoffend once they've been released from prison. And because psychopathy is so strongly linked to crime, the PCLR is being used more and more during things like bail hearings and parole hearings. But let me show you what I mean by that. All right, so if we take a group of 1,000 or so inmates, and they're about to be released from prison, and we give them the PCLR. Based on those scores, we split them up into three groups, right? The people who are the highest psychopaths, right, who score the highest on the PCLR, a sort of middle psychopathy group, and a low psychopathy group, right? Then we just sit back and we track each one as they're released and as they're taken back up into prison, as they're rearrested. And if we follow these groups out, some really interesting differences begin to emerge. In the low psychopathy group, you see that at the end of the year, only about 10% of them will have reoffended. Checking out the medium psychopathy group, it gets a little bit more dicey, talking maybe 30%. But if we look at the high psychopathy group, almost 60% of these charmers are back in the slammer after a year. Now, this is 20 years out. And we're looking now not just at recidivism, not just at committing any crime to get you back in jail, but at violent recidivism. It's not just enough to commit a crime, it has to be a violent crime. So looking out to about 10 years, we see that nearly 80% of the psychopaths will have committed a violent crime. Following it out to the full 20, we see that nearly all of our guys, we're talking 95% here, have done a bad, bad thing that's gotten them locked up again. All right. So let me now run some numbers by you that should keep you up at night. We currently have 2 million people incarcerated in this country. Let's be conservative and say that only 20% of them are psychopaths. So this means that there are about 400,000 psychopaths in the prisons right now, hanging out, lifting weights, waiting to be released. Now we know that violent recidivism rates for psychopaths reach upwards of 80%. So what we have here is a sort of ticking time bomb of violent crime. This is obviously a very bad, bad, bad situation, and we need to figure out what to do about it. We need to find ways to treat these people. Except there's sort of a problem. And the problem is, treatments just don't work very well. Actually, it's worse than that. I'll show you what I mean by that here. Say that we take a group of violent inmates and we give them the usual course of therapy in prison, typically some form of group-based behavioral therapy. Now, looking at the non-psychopaths, so far, so good. Okay? We see I'm not going to be able to show you the bars here, but what I'll tell you is that we see something incredibly striking. When we compare the non-psychopaths and the psychopaths with respect to their levels of violent recidivism and stratify them outwards according to who has and who hasn't received treatment. So for the criminal offenders who receive that standard course of treatment, they're actually much less likely to reoffend than the people who received, who didn't receive that treatment. But if we look at the psychopaths, we see a very disturbing trend emerge. If we look at the psychopaths and we compare the people who received treatment in prison versus those who didn't receive treatment in prison, we see that the people who receive treatment actually get worse. They become more likely to violently reoffend once they've been released, right? So what do we do? In order to better prevent and treat any kind of psychopathology, we absolutely have to have some sense of causality. We have to understand mechanism. We have to understand etiology and pathophysiology. We need to understand what it is that's going on in the brain that's producing these symptoms. Otherwise, we're just not going to be able to develop the kind of effective treatments that are going to prevent these people from going out and committing lots and lots of crime. Now, when we look at antisocial behavior generally, we see that there's moderate heritability. We're talking about 50% of the population variance in antisocial traits and behaviors that's accounted for by genetic factors. So that's antisocial behavior generally, essentially the DSM-4 diagnosis of APD. But a really interesting thing happens when we look at psychopathy, especially the emotional and interpersonal deficits of psychopathy, right? The stuff that really distinguishes psychopathy from APD. All right, a little bit of background on what I'm about to show you here. When we talk about psychopathy in children and adolescents, there's a number of really good reasons, like the possibility of stigma and the potential unreliability of PCLR criteria in kids, why we don't diagnose psychopathy in children. We just don't do it for a number of very good reasons. But that said, you can still see many of the core trait patterns in kids as young as 5. When we talk about the kind of factor 1 traits in kids, we call them callous, unemotional traits. And they're things like not showing feelings or emotions, ignoring people who are hurt and upset, not expressing remorse, having only a few friends, being unkind to younger children, and so forth. And antisocial behavior, the more factor 2 dimension, is also measurable in kids. And we can assess this by looking to see if a child is incredibly disobedient, often has temper tantrums, fights with or bullies other children, lies and cheats, and steals from home, school, and elsewhere. So when we look at these two facets separately in kids, we see something very interesting begin to emerge regarding their heritability. Looking at the callous, unemotional traits alone, we see actually very high heritability, upwards of 70%. And we can compare that with the heritability of the antisocial behavior, which is pretty low. But when we look at the kids who have both, when we look at the kids who seem to provide a best match to our idea of the adult psychopath, the kids who have both callous and unemotional responses to others and who show high levels of antisocial behavior, we get a heritability estimate of greater than 80%. And this makes psychopathy potentially one of the most genetically driven disorders in all the forms of psychopathology that we know about. Okay, so we know from these data that there's a huge genetic component that drives risk for psychopathy. Now, of course, environment plays a role as well. There's a consistent gene-environment interaction in determining all kinds of behavior, and psychopathy is no exception. But we know that genes are involved, and so our next question is, how exactly are these genetic factors expressing themselves? What are the mechanisms through which these psychopathy risk genes affect brain function and cognition to make them so damn susceptible to bad behavior? In what follows, I'm going to outline the 2 or 3 primary hypotheses about what is wrong with psychopaths. Generally, these break down into 2 competing accounts. On the one hand, some people believe that psychopathy represents a breakdown in the normal mechanisms through which emotions like fear, anxiety, and empathy are generated. We call this a bottom-up approach, because the fundamental assumption is that emotions drive behavior from the bottom up. We see an emotionally meaningful stimulus in our environment, we generate a physiological response to that stimulus, and that physiological response in turn drives our cognitions and our behavior. For bottom-up approaches, it's this basic emotional response that's lacking in psychopaths. On the other hand, some people believe that psychopaths can actually do an okay job of generating emotions under the right circumstances. But because of abnormalities in the way that they focus their attention, these emotional signals just aren't able to drive behavior in a way that they would for anybody else. So essentially, top-down models suggest that psychopaths can generate emotional signals, but that these signals have a tendency to be either overridden or ignored because of a broken attentional system. Now, these two models make very different predictions about emotional responsiveness in the psychopaths. The bottom-up model makes a lot of sense, right? A guy like Ted Bundy, take him for example. He seems to obviously lack some very critical emotional piece. Bottom-up models suggest that there's just absolutely no circumstance in which a psychopath will be able to generate a true, appropriate emotional response because the brain systems that are involved are just, well, broken. Now, one of the first bottom-up models was called the low-fear hypothesis. As the name would imply, it suggests that psychopaths have a specific deficit in generating appropriate fear responses. This hypothesis came out of a series of studies showing that psychopaths have lower physiological responses when anticipating things that should induce fear in people like you or me. For example, if you take a bunch of healthy people, of controls, and you tell them that every time they see a red square on their computer, they're going to get shocked or have a really unpleasant, loud blast of noise. Whenever they see that red square, they're going to start sweating, right? Their heart rate's going to go up. They're going to wince, which you can see as movement in the muscles around the eyes, called the orbitalis muscles. But if you take these same measurements in psychopaths, they're as cool as a cucumber. They don't really sweat, their heart doesn't race, and they don't flinch, right? So this is evidence that psychopaths are unresponsive to cues that are predictive of punishment. Normal people, when they see these cues, they generate these physiological responses, and those aversive physiological responses are what drive them to avoid the thing that's predicted by the cue. And you see the same thing, too, when you look at psychopaths' responses to punishment. Say that you make a task where a person has to pick between two random shapes, a circle and a rectangle. You tell them this, you don't tell them this ahead of time, but 75% of the time when they choose a circle, they're going to get punished with a shock. But they only get punished 10% of the time when they choose a square. If you have them do the task over and over and over and over again, most people will learn to avoid the circle and mostly just choose the square. Right? This is just basic operant conditioning. They learn to choose the square because they've associated the negative experience of the shock with the circle. And whenever they're about to pick the circle, their brain generates a warning signal that basically says, hey, wait a minute, stop. That's that bad thing from before. And you see that same pattern of sweating, heart rate increase, and eye muscle movement. Well, guess what? You don't see that stuff in psychopaths. They don't really show these physiological signals, right? They don't seem to learn from punishment. And for the low fear people, this was evidence that there was just something that's fundamentally broken in the way that psychopaths learn about and generate physiological responses to bad things or aversive stimuli or punishment in their world, right? If these people can't learn from punishment, then punishment of, or the threat of incarceration, which is in some ways an ultimate punishment, shouldn't have any effect on their future behavior. So the low fear model was around for a long time, but not everyone loved it. Some people felt that it didn't do a great job of explaining the kind of interpersonal aggression that you often see in psychopaths. They thought that low fear could explain a lot of the criminality, a lot of the risk-taking, but it didn't account for how psychopaths could just ignore the fear, the pain in another person's eyes and go on hurting them. And so, strangely enough, one guy named James Blair turned to dogs. James was a neuropsychologist who, for some reason, knew a ton about dogs. And he knew that there was this funny thing about dogs. When two dogs are fighting, and one of the dogs is just getting their ass kicked and is about to get really hurt, all that dog has to do is assume a submissive posture, like the one shown in the picture on the left here. And the other dog will just leave it alone. And he called this process, where one dog stops attacking after he sees another dog's submission cues, he called that a violence inhibition mechanism. So Blair thought, maybe humans have something equivalent. Maybe things like sad and fearful facial expressions are the human equivalents of these canine submission cues. And maybe it's the case that psychopaths, for some reason or another, are unable to recognize or process these cues. So for Blair, the bottom-up emotional response that was broken in psychopaths wasn't necessarily fear. It could be extended to the kind of automatic emotional responses that naturally occur when we see other people in fear or in pain. And it's the absence of these automatic responses, thought Blair, that could explain why psychopaths are just so callous, aggressive, and capable of these unspeakable crimes. And there is actually something to this. Quickly, I'm going to go through each of these faces. And I'm betting that if I asked you, each of you could tell me what each of these faces means, what it is emotionally that this person is experiencing in each quadrant of this square. And this task is called an emotional face recognition task. And when you look at face emotion recognition in psychopaths, they really suck at it. And they're the worst of all for fearful and sad faces. This would be consistent with the idea that psychopaths show high aggression and low empathy because they're not able to accurately read the kind of emotions that might otherwise inhibit aggression and spur empathic feelings. And so the other thing about this model that's been borne out by some data now is that psychopaths are also emotionally tone deaf. They can't distinguish well between fearful, sad, and neutral tones of voice. All right, so we have evidence so far that psychopaths have lower physiological responses to fear, that they don't show fear conditioning, and that they have trouble recognizing fearful and sad facial expressions. And as it happens, we know that certain brain systems seem to be really important for regulating and representing negative emotional states, brain systems involving regions like the amygdala and the medial prefrontal cortex. So it might stand to reason that dysfunction in this corticolimbic circuit could account for at least some of the deficits that we see in psychopaths. And in fact, people with damage to these regions show many of the same deficits in physiological responses to fear-evoking stimuli and punishment. They don't show fear conditioning, and they also have a hard time identifying emotional facial expressions. So people like Blair and others thought, hey, maybe psychopaths have some kind of amygdala damage too. And it turns out this was not a bad guess. When you give psychopaths tasks like punishment learning tasks and emotion recognition tasks, and you put them in the scanner to measure their brain activity, you actually do see lower levels of amygdala reactivity to these very aversive stimuli in psychopaths compared to non-psychopaths. Right? So it looks as though the amygdala and the medial prefrontal cortex are abnormally unresponsive to these kinds of stimuli that would normally make them go crazy. Why could this be? As it turns out, when you dig a little bit deeper, you see that the brains of psychopaths appear to develop in a very abnormal way. First, the size and the shape of the amygdala is bizarre. It's small and oddly shaped. So these size and shape differences may be one contribution. And on the right here, what I'm depicting is differences in the way that these two regions are wired together in psychopaths. When we look at brain connectivity, we see striking differences in the degree to which these regions can talk to one another. So it looks like these two regions, which normally interact to produce adaptive, emotion-based decision-making, essentially become uncoupled somewhere in the brain development of psychopaths. Right? These regions, I should say, also come up during moral decision-making tasks. Tasks where people are asked to judge whether it's morally permissible to sacrifice one life to save fives and so forth. Psychopaths have no problems making purely by-the-numbers rational decisions during these tasks, and they show changes in this same corticolimbic circuit that would be indicative of hyper-responsiveness to the same kind of emotional cues that would normally make people decide that, no, it was not morally acceptable to kill one person to save five others. So all of that would seem to be pretty compelling evidence for the bottom-up hypothesis of emotional dysfunction in psychopaths, except for one thing. In some circumstances, psychopaths do appear able to experience emotions just like anybody else. This was a tricky thing to find, but a few decades ago, an investigator by the name of Joe Newman started to see some very interesting and complicated alterations in the way that psychopaths pay attention to their world. And he first showed this using a very simple but elegant task that involved a rigged deck of cards. Subjects were given a computerized deck of 100 cards that had been arranged so that 9 of the first 10 cards were face cards, 8 of the next 10 cards were face cards, 7 of the next 10 face cards, and so forth. And they were told that each time they turned over a face card, they would get a point if it was a face card. Each time they turned over a card, they would get a point if it was a face card, and lose a point if it was just a regular old number card, a non-face card, right? And they could end the game at any time. So participants were just given this deck and told them to play until they felt like giving up. Now, as you would imagine, players earned points easily at first, but as the odds worsened, as you got later and later in the decks and there were fewer and fewer face cards, non-psychopaths noticed. And when they noticed, they stopped playing, usually after about 50 cards. Psychopaths, on the other hand, kept playing until the deck was almost finished and their winnings had essentially vanished. And after many, many studies that looked at this phenomenon, it became incredibly clear that psychopaths are just exceptionally good at paying attention to whatever they're currently focused on. right? With the card task, once they were focused on winning money, any new information that came after that, like the increasing cost of trying to win money, information from increasing losses and things like that, was just gated out of awareness. They seem to have this incredible selective attention so that once they're focused on something, they just can't pay attention to anything else. And you see this in classic cognitive tasks, like the attentional blink, which is what I'm showing right here. In the blink task, people are asked to pay attention to targets in a rapid stream of visual stimuli. Right? Most people will ignore this second target, this T2, if it's presented too quickly after the first, even if they're asked to pay attention to that second stimulus. That is, they blink after the first stimulus, and the second stimulus, information about that second stimulus, just doesn't get into awareness. But not so with psychopaths. If they're asked to pay attention to that second stimulus, that T2, they are incredibly good at detecting it. Once that's their goal, once they're locked in, they just do not see anything else. Nothing can distract them from that. And so, according to these top-down theories of emotion deficits in psychopaths, their apparent inability to respond to emotional information is actually the result of this attentional quirk. They don't take in new information when their attention is otherwise engaged. As I said previously, there's prior research that suggests that psychopaths are just unreactive, right? Their palms don't sweat when they're exposed to threats of shock or bad odors or things like that. But Joe Newman has shown that psychopaths do actually have normal responses, physiological responses, automatic responses to very unpleasant things, like the threat of a shock, right? They have totally normal responses, except when they're asked to pay attention to something else, and that's what we see here. Right? When they're asked to pay attention to something that signals that they might get shocked, their responses are indistinguishable from people without psychopathy. And that's what you see on the left side here. When the threat of shock is the focus of their attention, they respond completely normally. But when they're asked to turn their attention elsewhere, that's where you see the emotion deficit. So I'll leave you today with the idea that we're still trying to understand what it is about the brains and minds of psychopaths that enable them to do such terrible things. But one thing we know is that easy answers, like they have a broken amygdala, like they're just cold-blooded, like they're completely incapable of generating emotional responses, those easy answers are unlikely to get us to the place that we need to be in order to develop new and effective treatments. Thanks so much for your time.
Now, after that fabulous guest lecture, we're going to segue to our takeaway questions. So, the first question for today from our fabulous guest lecture by Dr. Joshua Buchholz is, what is the difference between psychopathy and APD, or antisocial personality disorder? Second, are psychopaths born, made, or some combination of both? And finally, are psychopaths indeed cold-blooded? That is, are they actually incapable of experiencing emotion? And now we'll conclude with our expert interview. This is part of our Experts in Emotion interview series. Today for our Experts in Emotion interview, we'll be speaking with Dr. Steven Pinker on violence and emotion. Dr. Pinker is an experimental psychologist and one of the world's foremost writers on language, mind, and human nature. He's currently a Harvard College professor and John Stone Family Professor of Psychology as well at Harvard University. His research on visual cognition and the psychology of language has won prizes from the National Academy of Sciences, the Royal Institution of Great Britain, the Cognitive Neuroscience Society, and the American Psychological Association. Dr. Pinker has also received 7 honorary doctorates, several teaching awards at MIT and Harvard, and numerous prizes for his books, The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, and The Blank Slate. He's chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary and often writes for the New York Times, Time, and the New Republic. He's been named Humanist of the Year, Prospects Magazine's The World's Top 100 Public Intellectuals, Foreign Policy's 100 Global Thinkers, and Time Magazine's The 100 Most Influential People in the World Today. So I now turn to our Experts in Emotion interview together with Dr. Steven Pinker.